In Units 11 and 12, we now take up the doctrine of man, and in Unit 11, specifically, the origin and nature of man. Where did man come from? How do we account for the presence of this unique individual upon this earth? There are really two basic views which men take today. One of these is the evolutionary, naturalistic, uniformitarian view, and the other is the biblical view, the view of special creation. Some have tried to combine the two with something like theistic evolution, that is, evolution with God at the beginning of it, but this is really not a very satisfactory solution, as we shall see. Really, the two basic views are not reconcilable. Either the evolutionary view is true, or the biblical view of special creation is true, and it seems to be impossible to combine them. Now, first of all, let's talk about the evolutionary view. We have already spent one unit on the theory of evolution back in Volume 2. But now let's review just a little bit and go perhaps a little bit beyond our discussion there in the area of man himself. According to the viewpoint of naturalistic evolution, a gradual process has evolved on this earth from non-life, that is, from inorganic matter, to a single-cell organism. Then, from the single-cell organism, we have the multicellular organisms. Eventually, these developed into the invertebrates, that is, animals or types of life which do not have a backbone, which do not have a skeletal structure. Then, presumably, this developed or evolved into the vertebrates, and in particular, the fish. Then, eventually, the vertebrates evolved into the amphibians, those species who are able to live both in the water and on the land. These eventually evolved into the reptiles. The reptiles, in turn, went in two directions, birds and mammals. And we are particularly interested in the mammal branch, because it is through this branch, presumably, that man eventually evolved. The mammals then became primates, the very top order of the evolutionary scale, and from the primates eventually emerged man. Now, we are particularly interested in our current study in this last step, the development from the primates into man as we know him today. Now, this last step in the evolutionary chain should be the easiest to document for two basic reasons. First of all, it is the last step in the process, and thus is not so far back as the others, and therefore should be susceptible to better investigation. And secondly, it is the smallest step in the entire evolutionary chain, and therefore should be the easiest to document and to prove. But as a matter of fact, this step is not easy to document. As a matter of fact, the difficulties abound on every hand. Now, the difficulties of the evolutionary view, particularly with regard to the last step from the primates to man, the difficulties lie in two principal areas. First of all, there is the total absence of the so-called missing links, the intermediary forms. And secondly, there is the problem of the dating of the fossils. Now let's talk about these separately. First of all, something about the intermediate evidence. Let me give you a few quotations which I have assembled here. In the March 1965 edition of the New Scientist Journal, we have this quotation. One of the prime difficulties, that is, in the whole area of tracing the ancestry of man, One of the prime difficulties is that really significant human fossil skulls are exceptionally rare. Everything which has been found to date could be tucked away in a large coffin. All the rest must be referred to something else. Unquote. Or in the Scientific American of June 1956, you have this quotation. Primatologists may therefore be forgiven their fumblings over great gaps of millions of years from which we do not possess a single complete monkey skeleton, let alone the skeleton of a human forerunner. We have to read the story of primate evolution from a few handfuls of broken bones and teeth. Those fossils, moreover, are from places thousands of miles apart on the old world landmass. In the end, we may shake our heads, baffled. It is as though we stood at the heart of a maze and no longer remembered how we had come there. Unquote. Julian Huxley, one of the foremost early evolutionists, said this, quote, "In the great majority of cases, the descriptions of the specimens that have been provided by their discoverers have been so turned as to indicate that the fossils in question have some special place or significance in the line of direct human descent, as opposed to that of the family of apes. It is unlikely that they could all enjoy this distinction. In the case of primate evolution, the inferences are sometimes very insecurely based because of inadequacies of the evidence." Nevertheless, in spite of the uncertainties, in spite of the lack of evidence, evolutionists do now generally agree that man and the ape family at one point branched off from a common ancestor. It is not correct, incidentally, to say that evolution teaches that man descended from the ape. That's not quite true. Rather, the view is that both the ape and the man descended from a common ancestor. Notice this quotation from The New Scientist again in 1965. "The unmistakable correspondence between man and anthropoids, that is, man-like creatures, points clearly to a common ancestor, but it has not yet been found, and we may have some difficulty in recognizing it." Unquote. Now, what evidence is there on which to base this particular theory? In 1965, there was a book published entitled The Primates, and the writers stated, quote, "Unfortunately, the early stages of man's evolutionary progress along his individual line remain a total mystery." Unquote. Now, this is a very interesting statement from a book written by evolutionists. The early stages of man's evolutionary progress remain a total mystery. And the Scientific American of November 1966 said this, quote, "The nature of the line leading to living man remains a matter of pure theory." Unquote. Another quotation from an article in the New York Times, April 1965. Quote, "Even today, surprisingly little is known of man's own family tree. There are still enormous gaps." Nevertheless, that's unquote. Nevertheless, there is general agreement among evolutionary scientists that probably the steps in order are as I have listed them for you on your printed material. In other words, the step from the primates to man follows the pattern which I have listed here. Propleopithecus, a type of ape, 30 million years ago approximately. Dryopithecus, another type of ape, 19 million years ago approximately. Ramapithecus, another type of ape, and Pithecus means ape, 12 million years ago, approximately. Then it really begins to come into modern theory with almost unanimity at this point. Australopithecus, some 4 million years ago. Then Homo erectus, and this now refers to upright man, Homo erectus, 1 million years ago, approximately. And then finally, Homo sapiens, or man himself, which is dated somewhere back to around 500,000 years by most scientists. But this will vary depending on the scientist, as we will see. Now, what is the evidence that this transition can actually be documented? I have before me here on my desk a copy of the Time Life Science series dealing with the descent of early man. And I have a diagram before me which shows at the very left-hand side a small monkey-type creature. And then as you go to the right, you have a successive stages of slightly larger, slightly more man-like creatures, until finally, after some 12 or 13 steps, you come up with a creature that looks very much like modern man, who presumably is supposed to be modern man. And if you were to believe this particular chart, and I'm sure that most of you have seen something similar to this, you would assume that there is overpowering evidence from the fossil records that each one of these types actually did exist, and that we have very firm, incontrovertible fossil evidence of each of these intermediate steps. As a matter of fact, we have nothing of the kind, and this type of chart is totally misleading. Let me give you some additional quotations here, which I think may be helpful. For example, from the Scientific American, July 1964, pending additional discoveries, it may be wiser not to insist that the transition from ape to man is now being documented from the fossil record. Well, why would they say that? There must be some terrible problem that would cause a scientific magazine to make that kind of a statement. All right, here is the problem. Again, I refer to the New York Times article, April 11, 1965. The Times says, quote, "A further step," meaning the step beyond the Propleopithecus of 30 million years ago, "a further step was the appearance some 19 million years ago of a genus with certain tooth features typical of man and the great apes. This was called Dryopithecus, found in Africa and Eurasia. So, from Propleopithecus, about 30 million years before the current era, to Dryopithecus, about 19 million years before the common era, there is a gigantic gap of about 11 million years in which there is no evidence." Unquote. Now, do you see this? From 30 million years back, the Propleopithecus, to the Dryopithecus, another type of ape, 19 million years ago, presumably, you have a gap of 11 million years and not the slightest evidence of any intermediate form. But then, as we go on in our quotations, we find, for example, from Science News, January 1967, "Unfortunately, there is a 10 million year gap in the fossil record between the latest Ramopithecus and the earliest of the Australopithecus." So here is another gigantic gap. And I could continue to document this. The point is simply this. We have certain forms which are dated at these extreme ages. And incidentally, I should say here in passing that I do not accept these dates as being genuine. I accept the theory of recent creationism, which we discussed back in Volume 2, and I believe that these dates are entirely misleading and are based upon faulty premises, but we're now using the dates of the evolutionist, of the uniformitarianist, and therefore we are simply using their dates for purposes of argument here. But even using their own dates, the 11 million year gap between Propleopithecus and Dryopithecus has no intermediate evidence. The 7 million year gap between Dryopithecus and Ramopithecus, no intermediate forms, no intermediate evidence. The 8 to 10 million year gap between Ramopithecus and Australopithecus also has no intermediate evidence. Isn't that strange? If the information and if the data are really so clear-cut as Time Life and some of the other sources would have us to believe, then isn't it surprising that we don't have better evidence? I think we should note here, as we commented on in Volume 2, that the really advanced research going on in this area trickles down into the textbooks and into the science classrooms many, many years after it actually takes place. And as I said earlier, perhaps the most uninformed people going on the whole theory of evolution are those who are teaching it on the college and high school level, with some exceptions. Now, when we come down to the last steps here, from Australopithecus to Homo erectus to Homo sapiens, surely we would be led to believe that here we have some firm evidence. But is this really true? Let's talk about the Australopithecus, the Australopithecines, if you want to use the plural. These are the so-called southern apes, those who begin to have some man-like qualities, according to evolution. For example, it is claimed that they were tool makers. I'm sure that you've heard about this at some point, that these are considered by many to be man-like creatures and perhaps even something approaching man himself because they made tools and were actually hunters. Well, let me give you a quotation or two about this. Science Magazine, December 13, 1957, contained an article in which we find this statement, quote, "This has to do with the Australopithecines. Are they contemporaneous with man?" Now I quote, J.T. Robinson reports the discovery of 58 stone artifacts at Sterkfontein in the Union of South Africa. This discovery is of great interest because this particular breccia also contains remains of Australopithecines, the early Pleistocene man-apes of South Africa. Robinson concludes that the advanced character of this stone industry makes its attribution to the Australopithecines dubious. He believes that the most reasonable hypothesis at the present time is to attribute the industry to a euhominid, that is, a true man. And a little later on in the same article, Mason thinks that tool making of the complexity shown in the Sterkfontein industry was probably beyond the ability of the Australopithecines, and that it must be ascribed to some more advanced hominid." Unquote. In other words, to summarize this and the other information that I have, the tools which were discovered in the area of the Australopithecine fossil evidence can always be attributed to man himself, to a higher form of life, rather than to the apes themselves. And nowhere has this evidence been found when there wasn't evidence of a higher form of life present also. Now, what about the fact that there is evidence that these creatures were hunters and thus perhaps semi-human? Again, from Science Magazine, this time November 1957, there's an article entitled "Hunters Are Hunted." I quote, "During recent years, Raymond A. Dart, to whom belongs the credit of having discovered the first of the Australopithecines, has written at considerable length about the social life of these interesting and controversial man-apes. Yet the data upon which his deductions are based, and hence his conclusions themselves, have proved somewhat short of convincing to at least some students of human evolution. The evidence advanced by Dart for the deliberate use of fire by these creatures has not withstood critical analysis. Moreover, competent students such as Oakley have ascribed the accumulations of non-Australopithecine bones found in the Australopithecine deposits to the activities of carnivores, including hyenas. Washburn concludes that it is probable that the Australopithecines were themselves the game rather than the hunters. Unquote. Now another quotation from a book by R.L. Lehrman, who is an evolutionist, 1961, wrote a book called The Long Road to Man. He says, I quote, "Australopithecus was merely an upright, intelligent ape, not a man. The small brain case bearing heavy ridges over the eyes, across the back, and down the center was like that of any ape." Unquote. Ashley Montague, the well-known evolutionist, in his book Man, His First Million Years, published in 1957, said this, I quote, "The skull form of all Australopithecines is extremely ape-like. Such creatures could not have been directly ancestral to man. The Australopithecines show too many specialized and ape-like characters to be either the direct ancestors of man or of the line that led to man." Well, now, what about the transition from Australopithecine, supposedly, to Homo erectus? Just one quote here from the Scientific American, May 1965. "There apparently is no direct evidence for any such transition." Or this quotation from the Scientific American of November 1966. Quote, "A recent fossil find in Hungary places a population of more progressive sapiens, humanity, contemporary with the populations of Homo erectus." So, it is very likely that Homo erectus, if it was human, was no more than a branch of mankind, possibly degenerate, that became extinct along with some other races of man. Now, what about the so-called Neanderthal man? Notice that we have him listed here under the Homo sapiens family because he is now realized to be a part of the real human race. But, of course, here we have the original caveman. Here we have the man who supposedly was the one who emerged from the very primitive type of man up to something close to modern man. And I'm sure that you have seen pictures which show the Neanderthal man as being a stooped, rather ape-like figure with very heavy shoulders, very heavy jaw, with a rather sloping head. I'm sure you've seen pictures. Let me give you a quotation here from the World Book Encyclopedia, 1966. "At first, scientists thought that Neanderthal man was a squat, stooping, brutish, somewhat ape-like creature. But later research showed that the bodies of Neanderthal men and women were completely human, fully erect, and very muscular. Their brains were as large as those of modern man." Unquote. As a matter of fact, their brains were somewhat larger than modern man by a couple of hundred cubic centimeters. But isn't it interesting that in the very same edition of World Book Encyclopedia, in a different article, has a picture of a Neanderthal man, and he looks like a squat, stooping, brutish, ape-like being. In other words, the various writers, even within the same encyclopedia, have not been able to keep pace with one another in the latest evidence. Now, what does all this mean? It simply means that the evidence which we are led to believe substantiates the transition from these various types of ape-like creatures up to man-like creatures and eventually man himself, this evidence is totally missing. And the various forms that we have are sometimes themselves questionable as to what type of being it was, whether it was an ape or a man. And furthermore, the links in between are totally missing, and the hypothesis is nothing more than a hypothesis. And furthermore, when you look at it from another standpoint, the hypothesis becomes totally untenable. Now, here's what I want to point out with regard to the dating problem, which is the second serious problem with this particular view. Now, notice that the Australopithecus fossils, the so-called southern ape fossils, made up of the tong skull and the natron mandible and the Schwarzkranz man and so on, all of these are supposed to be quite old. You see, the view is that Australopithecus eventually evolved into Homo erectus and then itself became extinct. And then Homo erectus gradually evolved into Homo sapiens and itself became extinct. But as a matter of fact, when you put all the evidence together, you find that even using the dates and the identifications of leading evolutionary scientists, you find that Australopithecus, Homo erectus, and Homo sapiens apparently existed side by side as far back as you want to go, even down to some 4 or 5 million years. Now, for example, the tong skull, which I have listed here under Australopithecus, is supposed to be in the ancestry of man. It is a part of the Australopithecus africanus, which is supposed to be the genus and the species from which man himself originally developed. This skull is dated by evolutionary scientists at some 800,000 years before the present time. But isn't it interesting that we now have evidence which places some of the later forms even farther back than that? For example, Louis Leakey, the famous anthropologist and scientist who has done so much work in East Africa, has discovered some evidence. For example, the right foot, which he found in East Rudolph in Kenya, which is dated, as best the scientists can tell by their methods, at 1,800,000 years before the present time. And yet Leakey himself, who discovered it, said that this is more like modern man than anything else. In other words, here we have a fossil which, according to its discoverer, is more like a modern man than any of the previous forms. And yet it is dated 1 million years earlier than the Australopithecus fossil that we were just talking about. Or, if you want to go back further than that, Richard Leakey, Louis Leakey's son, who is still doing work in East Africa, found a modern skull, which is not even named yet. It's simply called KNMER-1470. But according to the dating methods of modern evolutionary methodology, it is dated at nearly 3 million years old, 2,900,000 years old. And yet Richard Leakey said the skull is more like modern man than anything else. And when this particular find was written up in National Geographic, the writer said, "The discovery and dating of this skull compels a total rethinking of man's ancestry," unquote. And then if you want the ultimate, there was another find also in East Africa, the Kanopoi hominoid, which is now dated at 4.5 million years before the present time, and it is now thought by scientists to be closer to human form than to the Australopithecus. And yet it almost has to be Australopithecus if the date is correct, or unless the entire theory breaks down. Or consider another area in this same line. The Homo erectus, the erect man, which includes the famous Peking man, which was discovered in 1927, and which is dated at about 400,000 years old. It includes the original Java man, which was discovered in 1891, and is dated at about 500,000 years old. And the Heidelberg man, 1907, and so on. Incidentally, the original Java man was frequently referred to as Pithecanthropus erectus. Now, Pithecus, as we've already seen, means ape, and Anthropos means man. So the Pithecanthropus means literally ape man. And this was the old name which was given to this group of men, the ape men. Now, however, the designation is Homo erectus, the erect man. But now, notice these famous forms, the Peking man, the Java man, the Heidelberg man. All of these, you see, are in the range of 400,000 to 500,000 to 600,000 years before the present. And yet, we now have forms of Homo sapiens which date back to that same period. For example, you have the Swanscombe man, which is categorized as Homo sapiens, and yet dated 300,000 years before the present. The Tautavel man, 400,000 years before the present, or actually 200,000 years. The Steinheim man is dated 400,000 years before the present. And these are now of the same date as Homo erectus. And yet Homo erectus supposedly evolved into Homo sapiens. And then here's the real clincher. Just recently, just a few years ago, in Australia, in a place called the Cow Swamp, that's K-O-W, the Cow Swamp, there was found a man called Solo Man, who is identified as being almost exactly like the Java man. And yet, he is dated by modern means, modern uniformitarian means, at only 10,000 years old. And in the very same stratum, right nearby, Homo sapiens were found, which were dated 25,000 years old. Now, do you understand the significance of this? In the same place, nearby, in the same stratum, a man who was exactly or almost identical with Java man, who's supposed to be 500,000 years old, was found, and yet he was dated by chemical means at only 10,000 years old, and in the very same place, Homo sapien forms were dated as 25,000 years old. Now, how can that be if the classical theory is correct? You see, this turns the whole thing upside down and makes the entire proposition look like so much propaganda, which, of course, it is. Again, Leakey's findings in East Rudolph in Kenya have found forms which he has identified as Homo sapiens, as Homo erectus, and as Australopithecus, all somewhere between 2 and 3 million years old. Now, I think you can see that all of this turns the whole picture upside down. This is very much like the footprints which are found at Glen Rose, Texas, of dinosaurs and men in the same rock strata. And yet man is supposedly 50 million years more recent than the dinosaurs. Now, why don't you hear more about this? Why doesn't this sort of evidence come to light? Why, for example, was it 20 years after Dr. Dubois, who discovered the Java man, why was it 20 years before he finally revealed that in the very same place where he had found the so-called Java man, he had found other fossils which were of Homo sapien quality and were obviously modern man. Now, why was that not revealed? Why was this kept totally secret? I think only one answer can be given, and that is that such a discovery would have turned the entire timetable upside down. It would have discredited his original find, for which he became famous, and it would somehow or other have totally turned the whole picture around. And we find evidence after evidence that the fossils are classified not on the basis of terribly scientific data, but rather they are classified as to where they have to fit in order to make the charts come out right. Now you say, well, surely they don't do that. Well, surely they do. I was talking just recently to an anthropologist who has done extensive study at universities in the North and the East, who happens to also be a special creationist and a Christian, and he told me this. He said, I have come to the conclusion, after studying under some of the greatest names in this field, that you can put it down that whenever you have an ape, these men will make it look as much as possible like a man. And whenever you have a man-type fossil, they will always try to make it look as much as possible like an ape. And he said, you can discount entirely the pictures that you see of fossils developed into full-flown men or apes, because the fleshly portions, the nose, the mouth, the ears, the hair, all of this is absolutely imagination and nothing else. The skeletal remains of the fossils do not give indication of what the hair was like or what the ears were like or what the nose looked like. All of this is sheer imagination. And I have before me here also, and I wish I could reproduce it somehow in your material, three different pictures, artists, scientists' renderings through artists, of what the Neanderthal man supposedly looked like. And they are so different that you wouldn't have any idea that they were one and the same. One makes him look like an ape. One makes him look like modern man, and the other one is somewhere in between. Now, I think the upshot of all this is simply the following. We should not be led astray. We should not be stampeded into thinking that the fossil evidence, which is now available, is now so overwhelming, so complete, so full, so demanding, that we must cave in and assume that science has now once and for all proved the descent of man from the primates and from the lower forms of life. The evidence is no more complete than it ever was. One interesting thing that most people don't know is that when Charles Darwin published his famous Origin of Species in 1859, and then later his Descent of Man in 1871, in which he postulated this basic pattern, probably only the original Neanderthal specimen had been discovered. Everything else, which we now know as being a so-called human or human-type fossil, had not yet been discovered. Now, Darwin, working entirely from theory, without any hard evidence at all, stated that although there was no hard evidence at the present time from the fossils, he fully expected that as time went on, this evidence would be forthcoming. But as a matter of fact, it has not been forthcoming. And as the scientists themselves will admit in their journals, not in the textbooks which we read, not in the textbooks. For example, I have a textbook on my desk here, published by a leading firm, one which is used in colleges and universities as a science textbook, and it simply has this bald statement. No scientist today questions the basic validity of the evolutionary hypothesis. Isn't that a remarkable statement? I know several hundred that do. No scientist today questions the validity, the basic validity of the evolutionary hypothesis. Now, that's what you read in the textbooks. But if you read the journals, where the people are not trying to propagandize quite so much, but are simply reporting what they find, you will find very honest statements, such as some that I have quoted to you on this tape, concerning the fact that the evidence is very sparse, very scarce, subject to misinterpretation, and therefore we should be very cautious in postulating this dissent based upon the evidence currently at hand. Now, what is the option? If man did not arise from the primates, if he did not go from Australopithecus to Homo erectus to Homo sapiens, then where did he come from? And how are we to account for this creature called man? Well, obviously, the alternative is special creation. But someone will say, why can't we have the best of both worlds? Why can't we assume that man did come about by means of this evolutionary process, but simply assume that this was the process which God himself used to bring man into being? In other words, the theory of theistic evolution. Well, the reason this won't work is because it contradicts Scripture. As we will see in our next unit, the Bible says that man was created directly and immediately by God, and that woman was taken from the form of man. And there is absolutely no way, there is no possible way, that this account, if it is taken anywhere near seriously, can be reconciled with modern evolutionary theory. But my point in closing this unit is simply this. Why must we make the effort? Why must we try to compromise the biblical revelation in order to reconcile it with modern evolutionary thought? Because modern evolutionary thought is based upon so much conjecture, so much hypothesis, and so little evidence that it isn't worth the effort to try to put the two together. The only thing that evolution has going for it today is that it has been so widely accepted and propagandized that if you don't accept it, you're looked upon as some kind of a dummy by most people today. But that is simply because of the propaganda that's been put out for 100-odd years now, which has been based upon little or no evidence and has actually gone against much of the evidence which we have. And therefore, the Christian today can stand and say, I do not believe that it is proved. I furthermore do not believe that the evidence even indicates that we should move in this direction. And therefore, intellectually as well as spiritually, we can turn to the biblical revelation for the only genuine, true information concerning the origin of man. And we will turn to that in our next unit.